We've been going through Leviticus, and up until chapter 18, which we spent 2 months doing, up until chapter 18, Leviticus has been primarily ceremonial laws before God, meaning that God gave his people some rituals and a priesthood and different things that they needed to do in order to have a ceremonial purity before him, because God kept on reiterating the fact that he is holy, he is different from anything else. In order to have a relationship with him, you had to have a different walk of life. You had to have a holiness that we naturally as humans do not have. And so God gave them a ritual system in order that they might be able to do that. Then when you get into Leviticus 18, this book takes a turn. And it's no longer about ritual purity. It is now all about physical, moral, ethical purity. So meaning that these chapters do not have to do necessarily so much with a ritual ceremonial kind of thing, like meaning that it's not about like what we do in church. It's not about, coming in here and, doing a bunch of different sacrificial systems and stuff like that. It's all about how you live your life outside of church. And more specifically, it's all about how you relate to people. So Leviticus 18, as we talked about, is all about how you interact in your sexuality with other people, right? How you're supposed to use your sexuality and how you're supposed to honor God within your sexuality and to love others with your sexuality, right? And that those are there are very specific laws with that. Leviticus 19 and 20 gets more into the nitty-gritty of your day-to-day life. All right, so some of this stuff is going to sound odd to you guys because we don't live in the culture and society that they lived in. This was given specifically to God's people in the culture that they lived in. But you have to also understand the key to understanding Leviticus 19 through 20 is found in verse 18 of Leviticus 19. And verse 18 says this. It says, "You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." Right? That's the key verse to understanding Leviticus 19 and 20, meaning that Leviticus 19 and 20 are all about practically, how do you love your neighbor? How do you love the people around you in a way that honors God? That is what these chapters are all about specifically. So when you're going through them, instead of thinking like, okay, it talks about, and we're going to talk about stuff like this. It talks about, like having a farm and only picking certain crops, and it's like, how does that apply to me today? Always just think like, what is behind the law? Meaning, what is God trying to get at when he's giving the law to these people, and how does it commingle, or how does it relate to loving your neighbor as yourself? Right? If you think that way, you'll be able to understand the law in a really, really cool way. And the reason why we have to do this is because God is holy in a ritual sense, but he's also holy in a moral sense. It says in the Bible that God is love. And so if God wants to have a relationship with us, there's certain things about the way that you and I act that have to be altered, right? It has to change. And primarily, it means that God wants us to walk in love with one another, right? That's what God wants. This is very key as well, because by the time you get to the time of Jesus, so the law was given around 1500 BC, 1500 to 1800 BC, that's when the law was given to the people of Israel. So about almost 2,000 years later, Jesus comes on the scene, and by that time, the people of Israel, the people of his day, had completely missed the point of the law. The majority of Jesus' sermons, by the way, were trying to correct the way that the people viewed the law. So a lot of people, if you guys have atheist friends like myself, they might say something to you like, well, Jesus wasn't that great of a teacher. He didn't really say anything new. Well, that's kind of the point. He wasn't supposed to say anything new. Why? Because Jesus is the author of the Old Testament. He had already said it. All Jesus really did was he brought people to understand the Old Testament in a way that they hadn't understood it before, because man had taken the law of God and they had twisted it to make it a religious system as opposed to a system that helps people and encourages people in community to love one another. You guys get that? Right? So they had completely missed the point of the law, and they had turned it into something that made them feel morally superior as opposed to something that actually helped them love and take care of their fellow man. And I'll give you guys just three ways that the Pharisees missed it, and that's going to be really vital for us today, because the church misses the point of the law in the same way the Pharisees did. Right, so there's nothing new under the sun. we can miss the same points that the Pharisees did, and we do it regularly. The first point that they missed is that it is all about God. It's all about God. It's all about relating to Him. Okay? When Jesus was communicating with the Pharisees, when He's communicating with the different people of the law, at some point, one person asked Him, they said, Jesus, what is the first and greatest commandment? And Jesus said, the first and greatest commandment is this, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus is saying that loving your neighbor directly flows from loving God primarily. Okay? So that means that loving my neighbor has no bearing or meaning unless I'm first loving God. You guys understand that? Okay, it has no gravity in my life unless God comes first and God is the reason for why I am doing it. So when I hear from different atheists and different secular people in our culture today, they'll say like, well, yeah, you know, like God, essentially He just cares about us loving and taking care of one another. Or they may even ask something a little more pointed. They may say something like, I cannot believe in a God that would send basically good people to hell. Or I believe I'm going to heaven because I do take care of my fellow man and I do try to treat other people as I want to be treated. So wouldn't God reward me for that? And my answer to that is, well, yeah, that stuff is important. I'm not saying that it's unimportant, but in God's eyes, the primary tragedy of humanity is not how we treat one another. The primary tragedy of humanity is how we treat God. Right? So God is primarily interested in our relationship with Him. And from relating to God, you will relate to one another in a better way. But you always have to bring it back to the fact that it is primarily about God. The Pharisees had completely forgotten about that. They'd completely forgotten about it. Everything in their religiosity had to do with how it made them feel and how it was bettering their community around them. And it had completely missed God in all of it. To put it another way, there was no joy and there was no worship of God in the way that they were acting. It was only in self-imposed religiosity. Okay, classic example of this. Classic example of how this played out. Most of you probably know this story, but Jesus told a parable where He said there was two men who went up to the temple to pray. One was a Pharisee, one was a tax collector. The Pharisee goes up to the temple and he says, God, I'm so awesome. I tithe twice a week. I do this. And he starts listing all the ways that he's loving his neighbor, right? By the way, tithing was a form of community service, right? When you tithe, when you gave money, it was a way to help your community financially. And he's saying, I do this, I fast, I give to the poor, I take care of people. And Jesus said that he was praying thus with himself. Meaning that in all of his religiosity and all of his good deeds, God wasn't in the center of any of them. They were all primarily for him. And it had nothing to do with God. Right? So very easy to miss this point in our day-to-day lives. So when you think about your own morality, how you act towards your fellow man, right? How you act towards others, maybe even giving to charities or helping out in community efforts. The question that you should ask yourself always is, why am I doing this? Am I doing it because it's the right thing to do? Am I doing it because it makes me feel better about myself? Or am I doing it because I love God and I want to be closer to Him? Even when you think about different areas of the Christian walk, such as sharing your faith, giving your testimony, things like that. Once again, like, why are you doing those things? Right? Why are you doing them? Is it because you love God and you cherish your unity with Him? Or is it because, once again, maybe you have a guilt trip placed on you by a pastor and you feel like, oh gosh, if I don't share my faith, I'm a terrible Christian and I'm not going to heaven. Or is it, again, it's a genuine joy in the fellowship you have with God and you want to share Him with others? Right? So in everything that we do, we need to always center ourselves on that truth of, is this really for God or is this for self? The second way that they miss the point is they miss the point that the law was primarily about God, but it was also primarily about helping people. Okay, now it sounds basic, but just think about this for a second. During Jesus' earthly ministry, it seems to be that He made it a point to heal people only on the Sabbath. Right? It happens over and over and over again in the Gospels that Jesus is healing people on the Sabbath. And it seems so odd because you're like, you could heal people 6 days of the week. Why are you only healing people on the Sabbath? Well, He healed people on other days of the week, but He made it a point specifically in front of religious people to heal on the Sabbath. And the reason why he did that is because the Sabbath day, which is Saturday for Jews, the Sabbath day was a day where you were not supposed to do any work. And they had so made this religious thing about the Sabbath that Jesus, when he was healing people, they're like, you're not allowed to do any work, including healing. You're not supposed to help people on the Sabbath. And Jesus' response to them over and over and over again was, the Sabbath was made for man, meaning it was made as a benefit for mankind. It wasn't supposed to be a day where you stop helping other people. It was supposed to be a day where you stop focusing on yourself and you rest in what God has done for you. It wasn't about being less of a servant. It was about being more of a servant. You guys understand that? Right? They had missed the point of what the Sabbath was about, and they had wrapped it in so much religiosity that the law no longer helped or benefited people. It was all about ritualism, and it was all about legalism, and it was all about self-righteousness, right? Christians today can do the same exact thing, can't we? We get so wrapped up in our church culture that we forget that the church was intended to help other people. Even to the point where we can become uncomfortable with people that come into the church that don't really know too much about God, right? We become uncomfortable with their behavior. We become uncomfortable with certain language that people use. And we forget that everything that we're doing here is supposed to be about reaching the lost, right? And it shocks us when we hang out with lost people sometimes. It's really kind of backwards. You guys see that? It's also, again, very weird and sad when we think about the idea of giving money, time to other people, where we could get so wrapped up in the idea of just giving that we forget that giving is supposed to be to help others, right? So, for instance, when I talk to a lot of Christians, especially Christians around our age, we kind of get it in our heads, especially from the older generation, that there is a specific way that you have to tithe. Right? There's a specific way that you have to give your money. You have to give this amount of money to a church or something like that. And you forget the point that giving money is all about helping people, right? So it's like, yeah, you can give a certain amount of money to the church and be serving God, but you could also just give that amount of money to helping a friend, right? Or you give that amount of money to helping different things in your community that you see need help, right? It doesn't have to be specifics of just like you have to give in this way. You could instead just think like, no, the law of giving is about helping people, and that's what I want to do, right? And there are other things in that same genre, but just keep that in your mind. Like whenever you're following the law, has it become more about looking good at church and less about actually caring for the needs of other people? Has it become more about the letter of the law and less about what is actually good in every circumstance and situation? Now, I do need to talk about that one real quick on this topic, because there's a couple ways that we could go off on this. There's the Pharisaical way that I just mentioned, but there's also kind of more of the way that people in our generation are missing this point. And what I mean is that people, they take the law in such a way, in, especially in our generation, where they say the law is all about love. And so whenever they read something in the law that they don't like, they misinterpret it, they reinterpret it, or they just ignore it altogether. And they just say, well, it's more about loving your neighbor, so it doesn't really matter. So for instance, the stuff we were talking about with Leviticus 18 and the bans on certain actions in our sexuality. Some people would read Leviticus 18, they'd be like, well, yeah, it says that. You know, it says that, you know, in the Bible it says that I shouldn't have intimacy with someone before we are married. I know it says that, you know, I shouldn't be lusting. I know it says that I shouldn't have homosexual relationships. I know it says that, but the Bible's really all about love. And so as long as I'm loving the people that I'm with, it doesn't really matter if I'm not following what the Bible says I should do in this particular area, right? That's a very common thing that people say today. That's missing the mark as well, right? Following God isn't less than doing his law. Following God is more than doing his law, meaning it's doing his law and then also understanding the heart behind it and also understanding what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. And as we go through these specific commands, this will make more sense to you guys. The third way that they blew it is they had reinterpreted the loving your neighbor as yourself verse as only meaning people that they got along with, right? This is in the Sermon on the Mount. You can read it on your own time, Matthew 5 through Matthew 7. But at one point in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says this. He says, "You have been taught, love your neighbor, but hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemy. Pray for those who spitefully use you. Do good to those who abuse you." Right? So meaning that they had reinterpreted this idea of loving your neighbor, and they'd be like, okay, well, loving your neighbor means loving people that are close to you. Right? So as long as I'm loving people in my family, or as long as I'm loving the people around me, I'm doing the right thing. But I could hate those people over there because they're not my family. In fact, a lot of you guys probably know the story of the Good Samaritan. The parable of the Good Samaritan was given specifically to counter that ideology that had permeated Jesus' culture. Right? So a lot of people read the story of the Good Samaritan, and all they get from it is like, do good to your fellow man. That's not the point of the Good Samaritan. The point of the Good Samaritan is that Samaritans, for Jesus' culture, Samaritans for the people that Jesus was around, were one of the most hated people groups in the world. They despised them. They were massively racist towards the Samaritan population. And so when Jesus tells the story of a Jewish man who gets beaten and abused, and then a priest and a rabbi walk by him and leave him, what Jesus is saying is, these are the best people in his culture and community. He's saying, if they leave him, are they his neighbor? And the answer is no. What made the Samaritan a neighbor to the Jewish man? It wasn't anything with biology, genealogy, social status, or anything like that. It was all about his care for that individual. Do you guys understand that? So when we think about these laws of like, who is my neighbor? Like, who should I be exemplifying these things towards? Jesus is not simply talking about your family. He's not just talking about the people that you get along with. He's talking about the people in your life that you don't get along with. People in your life that you kind of hate, maybe. People in your life that may hate you or use you or abuse you, right? These laws are meant to be centered around how you treat humanity in general. Right? Why? Because Jesus so loved the world, right? God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, right? Jesus died for everyone, not just a select group of people. Jesus' love is for everyone, not just the people who love you. Right? There are a lot of people in this world that hate you, and Jesus still loves them. Right? So when we're talking about doing good to people, Jesus is saying do good to all people. In fact, he later goes on and he says, if you love people who love you back, what credit is that to you? Everybody does that. He says the most hated people in this community do that. If you want people to see something special in you, love those who hate you. And Jesus becomes our ultimate example of that, in that when he was being crucified by his enemies, he prays for them. He dies on their behalf as well as on the behalf of the people that loved him. He did not section up his love and say, this is only for people who deserve it. He says, no, my love is for the undeserving, because there are only undeserving people on this planet. So that's the third way you can miss the mark when it comes to the law. You could read it and say, oh, okay, well, I'm doing this. Well, why do you think you're doing it? Well, I'm doing it because I do this towards my family. But are you doing it towards everybody? Are you doing it towards even the people in your life that you cannot stand? Even the people in your life that may be actively against you, are you doing these things? Right? That's the convicting part. So that being said, that little precursor, let's get into Leviticus 19. So it says in verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to all congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Every one of you shall revere his mother and father and keep my Sabbath. I am the Lord your God. Do not turn to idols nor make for yourselves molded gods. I am the Lord your God. And if you offer a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord, you shall offer it of your own free will. It shall be eaten the same day you offer it, and on the next day, if it remains until the third day, it shall be burned in the fire. And if it is eaten at all on the third day, it is an abomination. It shall not be accepted. Therefore, everyone who eats it shall bear his iniquity, because he has profaned the hallowed offering of the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from his people. I'm not going to get into this, because these are things that are just reiterated, right? These are things that have been talked about throughout the book of Leviticus. And what he's saying, he's just bringing people's brains back, and he's saying, remember, this is about your relationship with me, right? So before God even gets into the whole list of how to love your neighbor, he's like, remember, right? Refocus. This is about me. This is not about your neighbor. This is about me. You glorify me by loving your neighbor, right? Your desire to care for others should be centered around me. There's another really important reason of why we must do this. When you're loving people who love you back, or you're loving people that you're in relationship with, it is easy to do good to them because it feels good, doesn't it? Right? It becomes simple because it feels good to do it. When you're loving people that don't necessarily love you back, or you're loving in a relationship that isn't really paying off anymore, when you're doing good things in those type of situations, it doesn't feel good. And so if you're only doing it out of your desire to please man or out of your own selfish impulses, you're going to stop doing loving things. The only way that you continue to love someone, even if it's not paying off, is if you're doing it for another reason that's above them. Right, so whenever I'm marriage counseling, so I'll just use this as an example. Whenever I'm marriage counseling, that's always the principle I bring them back to. So you have to get your eyes off of your spouse and remember that you're not doing this for them, you're doing it for God. Now, if you are doing it for God, you will deeply and passionately love your spouse because God commands and wants us to do that. But you have to remember, it's not about them. If you make it about them, then they're your God and they're your Savior. And that's why, again, he reminds them. He says, do not turn to idols. Right? Do not put anything above me. Do not make me the means of anything that you want. I have to be the end. So when you're loving people, remember that it is for God, not for self. Okay, let's get into the specifics. Verse 9. When you reap the harvest of the corners of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. And you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God. This is what it's speaking of is when, whenever you guys drive by Avra Valley or something like that, and you see all those farms, the farmlands out there, you see how they're kind of laid out in squares. What he's saying is whenever a new harvest would come out, the farmers would go through and they would reap, they would take all the fruit that was visible. Gleaning, what that meant is going through once and then going back through a second time and getting all the stuff that you missed. Right, that's what gleaning means. He also says you don't do that to the corners, meaning you only do the center of the field. You leave the corners alone. Why? This was Israel's form of welfare, if you want to think of it that way. This was Israel's form of welfare. This is how the people of Israel who didn't have employment or any amount of ability to take care of themselves, this is how they ate. This is how they were able to survive, in essence. And when you think about it, it's kind of cool. It's kind of a cool system. In that it allows for the people who didn't have a whole lot to be able to feed themselves and take care of themselves without begging, right? So they didn't have to sit on the street corner and beg. They simply had to go out and get their own food. So they had to do a little bit of effort, a little bit of work in order to do it, but it wasn't something in which they had to sit in street corners and beg for money. This was kind of like their welfare system, if you want to think of it that way, that they would do it this way. Later on in the law, it says the only real thing that was against people on this is it says that they could even go, you were even allowed as an Israelite or anyone to go through a field and just pick whatever you found, right? So if you're going through a field and you're a little hungry, you could just pick stuff off the branch and eat it. The only restriction that they had is you weren't allowed to bring any vessel, right? So you can't bring a big old basket and collect as much as you want. You had to just come through whatever you could hold. That was the law. That was the restriction. So how does that apply to us? Obviously, I don't know if any of you guys are farmers. I don't think so, though. I'm pretty sure none of you are. If you are, cool. I guess you could literally keep this. But for all of us who aren't farmers, what it's saying is take care of the poor and the needy. Right? The people who do not have means to take care of themselves, look for ways in your community, look for ways in your society to take care of people who are in situations like that. Now, there are a lot of good ministries that do that. Right, Gap Ministries, which is just up the road, does a really good job at providing for foster children and providing for the needs of homeless. Me and Bo, we go up to the Salvation Army. It's a fantastic ministry that helps out people who are homeless. It helps out people who are in need. Gospel Rescue Mission, places like that. And there are things that you can do. You don't have to always give money. You can give your time. You can go volunteer there. During the Christmas season, I know they always welcome volunteers to come in and help serve food and take care of things for them. So, man, if you guys are, you know, have some time and, you know, you finish your college semester and you're reading Leviticus 19, you're saying, how am I loving my neighbor in this aspect? How am I taking care of the needy and the destitute in my community? Right? You don't really know how to do it. Link up with one of these ministries, right? Just call them up. Ask them if they need any help. Ask them if you could be of service in some way. And I guarantee you they'll find something for you to do. The reason why I like those ministries a little bit better than others is because these ministries don't just go around handing people money, right? These ministries are actually focused on feeding people, taking care of them, and teaching them how to take care of themselves. Meaning it's not enabling them to continue in behavior. It's actually providing for them in such a way where they can take care of themselves, right, after a certain amount of time. So these ministries are amazing, and it makes it very easy for us in our culture and our society to take care of the needy and the destitute. You don't really have to do a lot of thinking. There are also really great ministries for people in other countries, because we always have to remember that the population of America is pretty low. We don't really have that many people comparatively to other countries. Right, so there are a lot of ministries that are out there. There are missionaries who are out there that even are from our church, who are out in China, and they're out in different areas of the world helping out with people that are a little bit more destitute than you and I. Right, so look into ministries like that, like Bridge of Hope, Gospel for Asia, things to that nature that are doing things to help people in those environments and in those places. Right, just always be thinking in your own heart, how am I using my time, my money, and my gifts, my talents to help out the people who are needy, right? How am I doing that? And for a lot of you, you may not have a ton of money to give, and that's okay, right? God's not looking at you and saying, like, you've got to give this amount of money. He's just saying, hey, whatever you have the ability to give, give. You know, if all you got this month is 10 bucks, yeah, that's okay. You know, you can give 10 bucks. But just are you, in your mind and in your heart, seeking out to help those who are in more need than you. Okay, the next section, this is verse 11. You shall not steal, nor deal falsely, nor lie to one another. And you shall not swear by my name falsely, nor shall you profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. You shall not cheat your neighbor, nor rob him. The wages of him who is hired shall not remain with you all night until morning. You shall not curse the deaf, nor put a stumbling block before the blind. But you shall fear your God. I am the Lord. So this is very straightforward, very simple, right? Don't deceive people. Right? So if you say that you're going to do something, do it. Let your yes be yes and let your no be no. Right? If you're dealing with people, don't manipulate them. Don't take advantage of them. Don't use them. The example that he gives, which I think is really cool, he says, the wages of him who's hired, this is verse 13, the wages of him who's hired shall not remain with you all night until morning. Meaning, back in the day, you know, you didn't have time cards and stuff like that. Back in the day, you just have people come work your field. And he's saying that a lot of masters, a lot of employers, figured out that if you pay people after they finish their work, they might not come back. So what they would do is they would hold your paycheck hostage. And they'd be like, if you want your paycheck, you have to come back tomorrow. And then they would put them to work again. The writer of Leviticus, God, is saying, don't do that. If someone does a good job, pay them. Right? Don't hold their money hostage and take advantage of them in that way. And once again, if you look beneath the law, if you look at what is being said to us, what he's saying is don't use shady tactics to get people to do what you want, right? Don't use their paycheck to take advantage of people. Don't use money to take advantage of people. If you have a power and you have authority, take care of those who work underneath you. Don't take advantage of them, right? So that's the whole point. When he says you shall not curse the deaf nor put a stumbling block in front of the blind, all he's saying there is he's saying, like, you know, do the right thing even if the person around you doesn't know that you're doing the right thing. So if you're at a job and you realize that, hey, like I could take a little bit of money from the register and my boss would never know. Or I could show up a little late and my boss would never know. You know, my friend could punch in for me or something like that. What this law is saying is don't do that, right? Do the right thing even if nobody's looking, right? Because you know that God is looking, and that's why he says you shall fear the Lord, right? So remember and know that you are ultimately serving God in your actions. Right? So do the right thing no matter what. Verse 15. You shall do no injustice and judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor honor the person of the mighty. In righteousness you shall judge your neighbor. You shall not go about as a talebearer among your people, nor shall you take a stand against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. So what he's saying here is when you're dealing with people, do not be partial or do not be unfair in the way that you interact with people. So no matter what social status we grew up in, all of us have a partiality, meaning all of us have a preference towards the people that we like to hang around. Right? And this is true for everybody, meaning that we always feel more comfortable where we're from. Right? So if you grew up in a middle-class family, you're probably more comfortable with middle-class people. Right? You hang out with super rich people, you might feel uncomfortable because you feel unsuccessful. You hang out with poor people, you might feel uncomfortable because you might think of them as beneath you, or you might think of them as criminals, or you might have different views on the way that they are. Right? If you grew up impoverished, you might look at people who are wealthier than you with disdain, meaning you might resent them, or look at them as spoiled, or unfair or unjust and not taking care of you. Right? If you grew up as rich, you might look at people who are impoverished and you might think of them as lazy or no good or thieves. Right? So there's a way that all of us view people from different social classes. You might be attracted more towards wealthy people, meaning that you might have an allure towards people who are in higher classes of society. It might attract you. You might want to be a part of things like that. And you try to surround yourself with decadence. What this passage is saying is it's not wrong to be rich, it's not wrong to be poor, but it is wrong to think of one class as being higher than the other. That's what's wrong. It is wrong to show partiality towards people. It is wrong to judge someone simply based on where they come from or what they look like. Right? That's what this passage is really getting at in the way that we behave. And once again, just ask yourself that question of how many people, how many friends or how many close colleagues or people do I hang around that are of a different social class than me? Do I feel comfortable talking or hanging out with people that are of a different social class than me? Or does it offend me? Right? When you're around rich people, does it offend you the way that they act? When you're around poor people, does it offend you the way that they act? Right? Do you show partiality? Do you judge people unnecessarily because of the way that they are, because of what class they come from? He also says not to be a talebearer. What this means is don't be a liar. When it talks about slander in the Bible, it doesn't just mean saying untrue things about somebody. A lot of times slander can be very truthful, meaning that you're taking true things, but then you're extrapolating them to mean something that they're not. So you take something negative about someone that you know. So you look at someone and you say, ah, man, like that guy, you know, I saw him do this or that, or I saw him yell the other day. So that means he must be a violent person. And so you start spreading rumors, or you start encouraging other people to think of that person in a negative way based on what you know about them. Do you guys understand that? Right? So it's just taking something negative about someone and talking to other people about it, right? Whatever it is. So it could be a friend, it could be someone in this church, it could be someone at your school, but you get together with your friends and you start saying things about them in order to paint them in a negative light, in order to make people think less of them. That's the idea of gossip or slander. So you may be telling true things in those moments, but what is your intent in telling those true things? Is it to make those people resent that person or think less of them? Or is it to make people think of you as being more interesting, right? That you have the scoop, you have the gossip, and that makes you someone that they want to listen to. That's just something that the writer of Leviticus is trying to get us to really think about in our own hearts. Now, in the church, we try to church it up. We try to make it sound more godly, and we'll say, like, oh, man, like, you know, let's pray for that guy, you know? And then they go in and they launch into this horrible gossipy story. And it's like, dude, you don't care about praying for that person. You care about sharing some gossip about them, you know? Like, you don't really care about their well-being, but you do care about putting them down. This also takes a legal context when he says, you shall not take a stand against the life of your neighbor. What he's saying is even more than that. Like, don't take someone to court for something that's not true. Don't lie about someone in a way that's going to seriously damage their reputation or seriously offend them. So he's taking it to kind of an extreme there. But also, don't just think of it in the highest form of, like, really hurting someone by suing them or sending them to prison for something that's false. But think of it on the lower end, too, of just, like I said, that small gossip that could eat away at someone's reputation in your group of friends. Verse 17, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the children of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. So if you look at the context of loving your neighbor, the context of that verse is specifically talking about people that you have a grudge against, right? So he's saying you need to love your neighbor as yourself. Why? Because I am the Lord, right? I love you. So you ought to love your neighbor. So this has to do with forgiveness. This has to do with forgiveness. Now, I like how this is put. It's really awesome. It's really cool because it does negate a lot of Christian ideology of what forgiveness is and what it isn't. A lot of Christians believe that forgiveness is taking things on the chin or being a punching bag for other people, right? So it's like, oh, I forgive that person. I'm tolerant of them. And what you really mean is you hang around this person and you allow them to abuse you or to use you or to hurt you, and you don't make a fuss about it. And you're like, oh, I forgive him, it's okay. That's not forgiveness. Notice what it says. You shall not hate your brother in your heart. You shall surely rebuke your neighbor and not bear sin because of him. So you're saying, yeah, don't be bitter at them. Don't be upset about them, but are you upfront with them? Meaning when they do something to hurt you, do you have the ability to call them on it? It's like, hey, man, that was offensive to me. Like, that hurt my feelings, right? You bring it out in the open immediately. If you ever want to cut off bitterness and you ever want to cut off gossip in your life, do this, right? The hardest, one of the most difficult things to do, isn't it? Right? Usually when someone offends us or hurts us, it's so common, it's so easy to pull in your friends, to pull in your colleagues, and to gossip about that person, right? Or to say like, oh, man, that dude's a jerk. I can't believe what they just did, just to vent. Right, but what's really hard is when someone offends you to go to them, to their face, and say what they did and how it offended you. Right now, some of us are a little bit more aggressive than others, and we got no problem with that. Right, we got no problem calling people on the carpet. But maybe you're kind of a jerk about it. Right, so maybe you're just so into you, and you're so into, well, I'm just being honest. You know, I'm just telling it like it is. Right, and you're so into that that you don't understand that you're actually damaging people. Remember, the purpose of the law is to love, right? If I am rebuking you because of the way you made me feel, my heart isn't with you, my heart is with me. Right? So a lot of times when we rebuke people, when we confront people, we're more interested in how their actions made us feel and we're less interested in helping them. Right? This idea of rebuking people is the idea of, yeah, be offended because of what they did to you. Yes, understand that there's a cost for what they have done to you, but also understand that your rebuke, your correction, is supposed to do just that. It's supposed to help that person change, right? So if your heart isn't on, I want that person to change for the better, for their sake, then there's a lot of selfishness in you, and that's why you're bitter, right? It also tells us, you shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the people, the children of your people. It also is telling us that in our anger, to forgive someone doesn't mean to think that what they did was okay, right? Obviously, if God's saying you shall not take vengeance, vengeance is the idea of requiting someone or paying them back for something they did to you. So God acknowledges here that there is some sort of a payment that they owe you. All he's saying is don't take vengeance yourself. In Romans 13, it's a very famous passage. I hate the fact that like almost no one in the church quotes the whole passage, though, because the whole passage is so good. It says, as long as it is up to you, live peaceably with all men. How many of you guys have heard that one before? Right? As long as it is up to you, live peaceably with all men. Almost no one knows what comes after that, though. Right? The very next section, the very next sentence says this, as long as it is up to you, live peaceably with all men, giving space for the vengeance of God, for vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Right? That's the very next sentence. So it's not saying just like, hey, man, just try to get along with everybody. Right, which is how most people in the church today take it, of just like, hey, just get along with everybody. No, no, no. The passage is about live at peace with people because God is going to judge them and you shouldn't take vengeance for yourself. That's what it's about. Right? So in essence, again, what it's saying is when I'm forgiving someone, I'm not saying what you did is okay. It's no big deal, right? Which is how we usually respond, isn't it? Someone comes up to you and says, man, I'm so sorry for doing that. Like, it's cool. Don't worry about it. It's okay. When you're saying that, you're verbally acknowledging the fact that what they did was cool. When you say, I forgive you, that's a very different sentence. I forgive you means, yeah, what you did was very uncool, but I am allowing my wrath to go to God. I am allowing God to forgive you through me. And I want to have continued fellowship. I am accepting and acknowledging that God is the true judge of your sin, and I'm allowing him to do his work, right? No matter how that is. There's much more I could say on that, but let's finish this up. Later on it says, you shall keep my statutes. You shall not let your livestock breed with another kind. You shall not sow your field with mixed seed, nor shall a garment of mixed linen and wool upon you. This is basically just God wanting to bring purity into every aspect of their lives. So he's saying, like, you're going to be so pure when people come into your country, you're not even going to wear stuff made of two different fabrics. Man, you're going to have the same fabric, and people will be like, why do you dress like that? Why don't you allow your cows to mix breed? Why don't you allow your crops to mix breed? And they'll say, like, dude, because God is pure. Like, God is whole. God is not tainted by anything. And so there's a symbol in our nation for that. Verse 20, whoever lies carnally with a woman who is betrothed to a man as a concubine and who has not at all been redeemed nor given her freedom, for this there shall be scourging. They shall not be put to death because she was not free. Okay, the idea of scourging, that means that there's a punishment. It doesn't mean these people are literally going to be whipped or something like that. It just means that God doesn't look okay on this. And he shall bring his trespass offering to the Lord and to the door of the tabernacle, meaning a ram as a trespass offering. Now, the reason why I want to talk about this for a second is because a lot of people look at Leviticus, they look at the Old Testament, and one of the reasons why they don't like it is because it mentions slavery, right? And this passage mentions slavery, right? It acknowledges slavery exists. It acknowledges that it's a functional part of their society. And a lot of people in our culture don't like that, right? We look at that and say, oh man, see, the Bible is totally out to lunch. There's no way we could follow it in today's day and age because we have moved past these primitive things and we've become better. You have to understand what slavery was in their culture in order to condemn it. When we say the word slavery in America, almost everybody thinks of the African slave trade, right? That's what goes through their brain. They think about Europeans, white European people, kidnapping Africans from Africa, bringing them to America and treating them as cattle, right? Keeping them against their will, forcing them to do labor without any money, and breeding them like cattle and selling them for auction, right? That's what people think about in their brains when you say slavery. In Israel, that wasn't at all what slavery was about, right? Have a good one, man. Slavery in that culture was a form of debt consolidation, right? So if you were in debt in that society, you would go into slavery, right? That's what would happen. But there were laws about slavery that were wildly different than the laws that we have. I'll just give you a couple of them so you can see this. Number one, all slavery in the Old Testament, in the Old Covenant, it could only last a maximum of 7 years. Right, so at the end of 7 years, there was a day of Jubilee, and all slaves were released. So that was the maximum amount of time that slavery could last. Secondly, if you were to hit your slave in such a way where it would break a bone or knock out a tooth, that slave was free to go. Right, so you weren't allowed to abuse your slaves. The third way it's different is that if you kidnapped the person that's your slave, that means war, having war with someone and kidnapping them, going into their house, kidnapping them, that was illegal and you'd be put to death. Right, so when you just look at those three rules, you see it's massively different than what we think about when we think about slavery. But what God is saying here is he's saying it's possible to be betrothed, because like I said, it's a form of debt consolidation. So you could be engaged to someone who went into slavery. And what God's saying is you cannot marry that person until they leave slavery. So you got to wait 7 years, or you got to pay the money for them and redeem them. Now, there's more to this. I've run out of time, so I'm not going to get through it. What I'm going to end this with is this really simple thing. When you read the law, you could look at it and you could be like, man, that was awesome, that was great. But for most of us who are thinking, we'll look at it and we'll be like, that sucks, I don't do any of that, right? Because that's the truth. Right? When I look at all these commands, I'm like, yeah, I slander. I gossip about people. Yep, I do not spend enough time thinking about how to help out my fellow man. I primarily use my finances to help out myself. In fact, I'm very greedy and selfish in that way. I am a liar, and I am kind of a mess in all these other areas. So you read through the law, and you realize the purpose behind the law, and you realize, man, I just don't do any of this. When Jesus came on the scene, not only did he reiterate the law, but he gave us a beautiful thing. He said in all of his sermons, what he was always getting at is that you will never be able to keep the law. You'll never be able to keep the law in the way that God intended for you to keep it. right? You will always fail because the law was given by a perfect God and you are not perfect. The intent of Jesus living a perfect life wasn't to give us an example. A lot of people think it is. It's not. If Jesus living a perfect life is all about now you have to live a perfect life like Jesus, then all of us would be massively depressed and we would never be able to get up in the morning. The purpose of Jesus living a perfect life was a picture of Jesus fulfilling the law that you and I never could, so that he can take the punishment of the law that you and I deserve, that we might have grace in the way that we live. All right, so we could look at the law and say, yeah, I do not keep this, but Christ came for law breakers, not law keepers. Do you guys get that? Jesus did not come for people who kept the law because no one kept it. Jesus came for people who broke the law. Now, when he dies for us and he rises again, he puts his spirit in us. And slowly what that spirit is doing is it's moving in our hearts to transform us so that we can keep more and more of the law. But none of us are at the place or position where we can keep all of it. Right, so as we go through our Christian lives, never get to the point where you're reading the law and you're like, I'm not doing that. I suck, right, blah, blah, blah. Well, you should be looking at the law and you should be meditating and thinking like, okay, I don't do that. Why don't I do that? Why don't I spend more time helping out the poor and the needy? Maybe it's because I have fear about my future and I don't want to help out other people because then that money goes to them and it's not helping me, right? And maybe God needs to deal with my greed, right? So I need to start praying about that and seeking a better heart. And maybe I need to start following the law even though I don't believe it right now, meaning maybe I do need to start helping out people and seeking ways to help people, even if I do not have joy in it right now, and asking God to change my heart. Maybe when I'm in church and I see the collection plate coming, I should just put something in there and pray and say, God, like right now my heart's kind of yucky, right? It's really greedy and I hate that I'm giving this money to you. But can you do a work in me so that I find joy in it? That as you gave your son and counted it joy, maybe I could give my life to you and count it joy as well, right? And just trust that God's going to do that work in your life, right? That's what a Christian ought to be doing, but we shouldn't be looking at it and condemning ourselves, and we also shouldn't be looking at it and saying like, man, I'm keeping all this, I'm awesome, right? You're missing the point both ways, right? Jesus came for people who broke the law, but he came to make us people who would keep the law, right? And that's the whole point of the gospel. So let's pray, and we'll wrap up for tonight. Father, I thank you so much that you have come for people who can't keep the law, for I know that I can't. Lord, there's so much in here that I recognize in my own heart that I'll never be able to do. Lord, I have so much greed and so much lust and so much selfishness in all that I am. Lord, please continue to set us free from these things. Continue to transform us more and more into the image and likeness of your Son, that we might honor you and love you. And help us to always remember that the purpose of the law is not to make us feel superior or better than others. It's not so that we could be legalists or Pharisees. The purpose of the law is about unity with you, Lord. So help us to have humility as we focus on these things, and help us to have love for you in all that we do. And in your name, amen.